Line six, I'm sorry, I should have given you that. In general, the way the task force approached liability was where it found that people were being asked to do things that were similar to what other people in the process were being asked to do and were for no apparent reason excluded from exemption, we were looking at it in that light. The second thing that occurred in there, Brad Swank's drafting, he did an excellent job of drafting this bill so that it reorganized it and put it into logical sequence. But what it also did was brought juxtaposition some of the liability things from various parts of the statute and raised a lot of questions. And I think that's part of where the liability questions are being raised. But these that I'm mentioning right here are the core liability issues that were initially identified by the Civil Commitment Task Force, that where it felt that they should be extended to these people as well as to other people, and that the case manager ought to be exempt as well as the county mental health program director. The next area is to restrict the use of emergency commitments to those parts of the state where a circuit court judge would not have jurisdiction of commitments. This is section 21, page 16, line 23. It in some instances, counties were felt to be using this emergency commitment inappropriately. It was originally designed to come into a play when no judge was available in the county, and it was a consensus that where counties were still admitting people directly to the state hospital without an investigation and without the processes that are provided by the other commitment procedures, that in this day and age there are judges in all the counties, and that was really not an appropriate use of this bill. Now the bill, this part of the statute is also used for the Indian tribes to use their tribal councils to do civil commitment, and so that was left in. So the only thing that remains of the old in this bill of the old emergency commitment statute is that the tribal councils can still use it for that purpose, and that's the reason for that. Finally, there was an attempt to reduce a variety of inconsistencies in the statute about designation of court of jurisdiction, responsibility for investigations, and length of emergency holds. There are a whole series of citations here, and I would defer those if they're not the major, they're not as major as the others, but are all designed to make the bill consistent. Makes it only a circuit court judge with legal training would be doing the process. Another makes consistent the lengths of all these holds so that they're not there's not a variety of different lengths of time for the various commitment processes and so forth. Now, attached to your testimony, you'll find a detailed description of House Bill 2324. It's Attachment A. What we've done in Attachment A is take, you'll find that the task force report is outlined in terms of problems and solutions, and that's the way the task force worked. If in the process of the task force, after we took all the testimony, reviewed all the surveys, and looked at everything, then we got the work of the task force was, is this really a problem? Do we really think it's a problem? If it's not a problem, we're not going to solve it. And we generally voted on whether or not it was a problem. If it was a problem, then we began to look for the solutions. We've taken the problems and solutions out of this report and pulled them into this, it's not really an analysis. It just puts them so that you can go through this bill and understand what each section is dealing with. And parts of it are merely changes by the reorganization, as I mentioned before. By reorganizing the statute, things are deleted in one place and brought back up in another. And you'll probably read that with much more ease than I do. A final thing that's attached is the fiscal impact. That's attachment B. This answers another question that was raised earlier about the voluntary patients. We're projecting now, and we haven't pulled the list yet, but as we pull the list, we're projecting that there'll be in the range of 1,300 or more people who will receive services either voluntarily or involuntarily. Now, we're not going to exclude the voluntaries, and I think that we haven't been able to discuss this enough with everybody yet, but the proposal is that if a person is in one of these episodes of deterioration and are willing to come into service voluntarily, we certainly don't want to say, no, we can't serve you. And it's our anticipation that by intervening earlier, we'll have more and more who will agree to come in voluntarily. And it's the objective, as you read through the goals of the task force, it's the objective of all of us to try to get as many people voluntary as possible. And I think the very practice of early intervention brings more people in voluntarily, brings people, more people in into the system voluntarily. So the money would be spent for a range of community services. We're not spending them for the state hospitals. That would include the use of local hospitalization, local non-hospital crisis services, community support, which is case management, medication management, and residential services in our foster homes, group homes, and semi-independent living facilities. All the money would be spent for that, to put these people either voluntarily or involuntarily into a community alternative. Many times, if they go involuntarily, we will utilize that mechanism of outpatient commitment I was mentioning, and they would be there on that outpatient commitment, and then if they began to violate the terms of that outpatient commitment, they would move back into the system. So that's where the big bulk of the money goes. The $622,000 goes for an addition. We anticipate that all the stuff we've asked the commitment investigators to do will require additional hour in that time, and that the cost of that is $622,000. From there on down on the page, the costs are not covered. The if you've totaled that first two, you realize that totals to the 7.1 million that we're talking about
in the governor's proposal.
Yes, and so I think we have some problems in these other areas. But we're trying to be as clear as possible about all the potential fiscal impacts of this. So this could require amendments. I might add one final comment, and that is that this statute has made so many significant changes that we have found a few other minor things and will be submitting some amendments to you, but I think they're not substantive in nature.
Questions of Dr. Gray? Representative Dix.
So, in your opinion, does this bill go as far as we need to go in this area?
I think it goes as far as we need to go in 1987. I think there will be an intensive study of what happens as a result of this, and I would fully anticipate that we would be back in 1989 proposing some further changes, but we would have some data to say precisely what happened, how many of these people we found, what the results of this early intervention were. So for right now, I think it's precisely how far we should go.
Okay. Dave?
No further questions.
I'm sure that we know where to get a hold of you.
Yes.
And I want to thank all of you and all the members that put in substantial time in bringing the report forward.
Thank you.
I did have one further. I'm sorry. If you look at page 23 on the liability issue, tell us about sections 6 and 7 and how those came about.
Page 23.
Yes. I'm sorry, section 31, sub 6 and 7.
Oh, okay. The concern here was that people who were assuming responsibility for mentally ill persons on conditional release should be exempt from damages sustained by any person on account of misconduct of the mentally ill person while on conditional release. The reason is that makes it parallel with the way the statute now reads on trial visit. The people who are taking the county mental health program director, the superintendent, are if they've acted in good faith, are not liable for actions of a person. So this extends the same kind of protection to family members who are willing to assume some responsibility for caring for their family members.
Doctor, in looking at that, it appears sections 1 through 5 do provide if a person is acting in good faith and without malice, they shall not be held criminally or civilly liable. The reason I ask you about sub 6 and sub 7 is because the different language appears there that says shall not be liable for any damages whatsoever. And there's no reference made to either good faith, probable cause, or malice. Besky, did
yes.
you have a comment on that?
Mr. Chair, let me refresh Dr. Bray's memory on this whole issue. The first parts of this you're talking about, for the record, Mike Besky, State Rep, District 33, you're talking about notifying somebody and bringing an action. I think this person is mentally ill, therefore, you know, do something about it. And that's the malice issue. That's why you're talking about good faith, probable cause, without malice. If those standards, if I was to say, tried to get you committed, Mr. Chair, did that with malice, then you would have the right to bring a civil action against me. Of course, I wouldn't do that because you're chairing the subcommittee. The sub 6 and 7 has to do with the actions of the individuals when they're under this conditional release. They're already committed. It's how much of a duty do I have to protect others from the person under whose charge that I have. Does that help?
That's the reason for the differing standard included in the bill draft.
Sub 6 and sub 7, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's a total exemption from liability.
Where the rest are not.
Right.
I would hope the reason that you wouldn't initiate such an action would have to do that I wasn't within the group rather than I chaired the sub.
It's both. It's both, quite frankly, Mr. Chair. But this was an issue, as Dr. Bray stated. This was an issue that really wasn't discussed fully in the task force because we didn't realize the problem and differences until Mr. Swank had reorganized the chapter and set these limitations on liability into one place so that we saw, because they were juxtaposed, that over the years certain groups were omitted from the exemption. And it was brought to us late, and we agreed to discuss. Well, we agreed to have the legislative committees discuss this issue. I think you should take a look at sub 6 and sub 7, and it's been my position perhaps impose a gross negligence standard. In other words, that if it's negligence per se on its face, simple negligence, whatever term, if it is that, the person is immune from liability. But if there is a wanton, reckless disregard, gross negligence standard, that perhaps there ought to be liability for that individual. I think you'll hear some more testimony on this issue, discussion, and I hope this committee will look into that issue as well.
Thank you.
Thank you both. We're going to before we break, I've just got a couple of comments to make. I'd ask everybody to listen carefully. If you would, on the registration list that I've got signed up, or that I've got up here, I'm going to put it out by the coffee again at break time. We don't have a place for you to put where you're from, but if you've already signed up, would you just put what town you live in so that I know I want to get you up here if you got a long way to go home? Second of all, we will have this hearing on, for public hearing again, on Tuesday, February the 10th. And if you appear on this witness list, and it's getting to be a long afternoon after break, and we call you and you're not here, your name will be the first one called come February 10th when we continue the public hearing on this bill. That's for everybody's information. We got 3:25. Why don't we come back at 25 to 4? Thank you.